a new and novel coronavirus.
Is there a difference in outcomes if we use human versus analog insulins?
Treating a bacterial infection to prevent gastric cancer.
And one marker of kidney injury, does it help? That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. And some of our listeners may or may not be aware that we've changed our name from PodMed Double T to Double T Health Watch to more closely reflect and align with Texas Tech University, the prime sponsor and supporter of the podcast. So, Elizabeth, where do you want to go?
Well, I think we have to start with you because we are taking a look at all of this abundant data that's out there relative to this new coronavirus that has emerged in Wuhan, China, and of course now has made its way pretty effectively around the world.
So there were a number of articles. We're going to address two, one in the New England Journal of Medicine, the other in Lancet. So let me take a step back and say we've known about coronaviruses before. There are at least six previously identified that can infect humans, four of which cause kind of a common cold. And the other two cause severe respiratory diseases. One was called SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, and the other was the Middle East respiratory syndrome, or called MERS. Over the last couple decades, over 10,000 people have been affected with those two coronaviruses, and the mortality of those was about 10% for the SARS virus and about 37% for the MERS virus. Well, most of our listeners will be aware that another novel coronavirus has been identified in Wuhan, China. Based upon fluid obtained from the lung samples, they did deep sequencing analysis to identify this novel coronavirus. This shares a lot of similarity, about an 85% similarity to the SARS and MERS virus. We've identified the virus. What are the clinical characteristics of patients that are infected with this? And this reports on 800 patients, the first 800 patients. Now, I must say that since this report came out, there are now over 5,000 cases reported with a mortality of about 3%. Based upon the initial 800 patients, the vast majority were men. Less than half had some underlying disease. 98% of patients had fever. A cough, about 3/4 of the patient, and it was mostly a dry cough. Headache was fairly uncommon, which differentiates it from the flu. Acute respiratory distress syndrome in about 29% of people. Acute cardiac injury in 12%. Secondary infection in 10%, and about a third of the patients were admitted to the ICU, and about 15% died.
I think one of the things that's really concerning to me about this virus is the fact that just yesterday I saw that people can be asymptomatic and be effectively shedding viruses all over the place for 2 weeks sometimes. Also, we're seeing what appears to be perhaps increasing effectiveness of human-to-human transmission.
Absolutely. So, Elizabeth, as you said, the incubation period is about 3 to 14 days. Human-to-human infection is a serious problem. We don't know what the pathogenicity is. Is it extremely infectious? It's really hard to say. It does appear, however, that the mortality associated with is less than with the SARS and MERS virus.
That at least is good news. And I would say on the good news front, there's also the fact that the international cooperation relative to this particular outbreak has really been impressive. And I feel that even China has tried very hard to try to isolate Wuhan and the folks there. Of course, it's already the cat's out of the bag. But it to me seems like it's really a very global effort.
It is. The WHO got involved very early on.
And I feel absolutely certain we're going to be talking more about this. Let's turn to JAMA Open. This is something that speaks to my heart. This was a look at differences in cardiovascular outcomes between people with diabetes who were using analog insulin versus human insulin. The reason it speaks to my heart is because I'm even going to use this person's name, Alex Smith, who was a Minnesotan who died at 26 years of age because he was rationing his insulin because he couldn't afford it. That's why this particular study is one that I picked this week, because I think it has huge public health implications. Many people go on these Canadian caravans in order to obtain insulin and other diabetes meds less expensively than they can in the United States. And it's largely a poster child, I think, for what is really needed to reform in terms of pharmaceutical prices. So now that I've editorialized about that, what did they do in this study? It's a retrospective analysis of 127,600 adults between the ages of 21 and 89 years with type 2 diabetes. They were looking at four healthcare delivery systems. They initiated insulin therapy between January 1, 2000 and December 31, 2013. They took a look at overall mortality, mortality due to cardiovascular disease, MI, stroke, or hospitalization for congestive heart failure. They found that there were no differences between these two groups, those who took analog insulin versus those who took human insulin, for those very important and meaningful cardiovascular outcomes, which is clearly one of the things that we're trying to prevent when we put somebody on insulin when they have type 2 diabetes.
And the major impetus for using analog rather than human insulin is early studies suggested there was fewer incidences of hypoglycemia associated with it. I would say that's a little bit of a surrogate endpoint. You actually want a hard endpoint. And that is, do the analog insulins reduce mortality or cardiovascular disease or stroke or hospitalization? And as this study suggested, they don't do that any better than human insulin. Now, you mentioned the cost. A 10 mil vial of human insulin cost about $25. The analogs, about $290 to $300 for the same amount.
I thought one of the things the authors asserted in here is there have been no randomized clinical trials that have actually compared these two types of insulin to each other relative to major cardiovascular events or mortality.
And that's true. I mean, to do that study, it would take thousands of patients followed over a long period of time and be very expensive. And quite frankly, producers of analog insulin really don't have the motivation to do that because they're so widely used, predicated upon the fact that they reduce the incidence of hypoglycemia. That's why this is a very important study.
And I'm hoping it's practice changing, that physicians who are listening to this say, you know, okay, maybe I really don't need to keep my patient on these analog insulins. Even with regard to the human insulins, the price gouging is just really dramatic.
Our listeners that are taking insulin should speak with their physicians if they'd like to reduce their cost, especially if that's preventing them from getting their daily doses.
Let's turn back then to the New England Journal of Medicine, a study that takes a look at another what I consider to be pretty important public health issue. What happens if we treat Helicobacter pylori infection for people who are at risk for gastric cancers?
Now, I'm going to shorten and call it H. pylori. It's a common bacterial infection of the human stomach. In fact, it affects more than half the world. There is clearly an association between H. pylori infection and gastric cancer. If that's the case, if you just treated a large number of people for H. pylori, that you could prevent cancer in the future. Let's take people we know that are at high risk, those that have a family history of gastric cancer. That increases your likelihood of developing gastric cancer about 3 to 4-fold. That's exactly what these authors did. They looked at 1,676 participants, half of whom were randomized to receive treatment for H. pylori, and that involved receiving a proton pump inhibitor, lansoprazole, as well as two antibiotics, amoxicillin and clarithromycin, those antibiotics twice daily for 7 days. The other group just received placebo, and they followed them for a median follow-up of 9.2 years. And what they discovered is the individuals who received treatment for H. pylori, it reduced their risk of developing gastric cancer by 55%. Wait, there's more. Not everybody that's treated actually has eradication of the H. pylori. So when they looked at those that they could prove that, in fact, the H. pylori was gone, it reduced their cancer risk by 72%.
I wonder if this suggests something that we've talked about in the past, and that is kind of routinely screening. You've already identified that 50% of people on the planet have H. pylori resident in their gastric mucosa. Should we be taking a look at that and trying to eradicate that just in general?
That's a great question. It's difficult to say whether treating the entire population or half the world is the right approach, but I think we could both agree that if you have a family history of gastric cancer, taking a week of antibiotics, the cost-benefit analysis there would support that.
Remaining in the New England Journal of Medicine, now we're going to take a look at something that's entitled Soluble Urokinase Receptor in Acute Kidney Injury. Kidney injury, of course, really an important problem and a growing problem. It occurs in 2 to 5% of hospitalized adults and has a major impact on morbidity and mortality and healthcare utilization. How do we figure out who might be at risk for that? In this study, they took a look at plasma levels of something that's called soluble urokinase plasminogen activator receptor, or suPAR, which is how I'm going to refer to it going forward. They measured plasma levels of suPAR pre-procedurally in patients who were going to have coronary angiography and patients who underwent cardiac surgery, and at the time of admission to the intensive care unit in critically ill patients. The totals were 3,800 plus patients in the coronary angiography group, 250 for cardiac surgery, and 692 who were critically ill. They assessed the risk of acute kidney injury at 7 days as the primary outcome and acute kidney injury or death at 90 days as a secondary outcome. They found that this was a predictive marker, and there was a what I'm going to call a dose response. The higher your level, the more likely it was that you were going to have a more severe kidney injury. The authors feel fairly confident that this could be added to the group of assessments that are done, and then they also validated their hypothesis in a mouse model. The editorialist, though, is a little less sanguine about the utility of this. What are your thoughts?
What the investigators proposed is that suPAR is not just a marker for acute kidney injury, but actually participates in it as well. The hypothesis is suPAR is directly involved in the development of kidney injury by sensitizing the kidney to injury through modulation of cellular bioenergetics and by increasing oxidative stress. If you want to prove that, you get a mouse model and you overexpress it to prove they're more prone to kidney injury, which the investigators did. And then you give an antibody to the protein to show that you can actually reduce kidney injury. What are the implications for humans? If it does participate and you can identify people that have high levels of it, that are predisposed, and they're going to have some procedure that might cause kidney injury, if we can lower those suPAR levels, then perhaps we can reduce the acute kidney injury. And that's the next step.
And so in their mouse model, they inhibited suPAR with the use of a monoclonal antibody, and they were able to reduce the injury due to the contrast agents. What are your thoughts, though, about what the editorialist says, that this is really not ready for prime time here, that it's just one more thing that could be measured? Maybe it would prompt a more thorough investigation for acute or chronic coexisting conditions.
Certainly acute and chronic coexisting conditions increase your risk of acute injury. I think the investigators have done a very good job in taking it as far as they can without doing human studies. The next step is to see in humans whether we can replicate this.
Here's my last question about this. How do you account for the fact that kidney injury is increasing?
As we add more chronic conditions, we're also doing a lot more procedures, perhaps, than we have in the past. A lot of procedures that require contrast. And the more contrast agent one receives, the more likely one is to have acute kidney injury. We're also spending a lot of time treating people in the intensive care unit, and people are going for cardiac surgery, especially older individuals that have other chronic conditions that predispose them. So I think it's the totality of how we're caring for patients right now.
More to come, undoubtedly. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.